it's hard to explain, but it's sometimes you see for people what works and what doesn't work. Like, it's the same if one guy comes into our store, it's like, hey, I need a powerful suit. Okay, so what does that mean, a powerful suit? Does that mean a loud suit? And then they grab the heavy pinstripe. Like, is this your first suit? Yes, yeah, it's my first suit. Like, no, you don't want to become the guy in the pinstripe suit.
Right.
And that suit will wear you instead of the other way around. It's like, you want to a powerful suit is a suit that's tailored well, that you feel comfortable in and confident. And that's the same thing that you can relay back on the watch game. It doesn't work if it doesn't work for your personality.
Hey everybody, this is your host Stephen Pulmerant, and this is Hodinkee Radio. This week, we've got Nishta Gruder, the Vice President of Suit Supply, who first brought the brand to the US back in 2011. The guy loves a good watch, a good suit, and a good glass of tequila. I've got to say, I'm honestly shocked we weren't already friends. He makes for a great conversation, and I really enjoyed this episode. I think you're going to love it. Then we've got our own Joe Thompson sharing a little piece of horological history about a special man and his special watch. But first, I don't know if you've been following the story, but Cleveland Browns wide receiver Odell Beckham Jr. has been getting a lot of attention for more than just his play on the field. There's a little bit of a horological controversy here. I was able to get Kara, James, and Gray into the studio to break down the story, and there's a lot to talk about. Let's get into it. This week's episode is presented by Grand Seiko. Stay tuned later in the show for a look at one of the four watches from the new Seasons collection, which is exclusive to the US. For more, visit GrandSeiko.com.
So what are we talking about today, Stevie?
What are we talking about? It's been a big week.
Let's go.
We got a lot going on. I can tell you're weekend ready?
Yeah, yeah.
James, you ready to go back to Canada? Get out of this country?
Absolutely.
He says with a hat pulled down over his face and a big glass of coffee right there.
Is that a quadruple shot of espresso?
It's one espresso and a little bit of milk.
Looks pretty good.
All right. Big week in watches. First thing we got to talk about, the thing I don't think we've stopped talking about all week, is our good friend, Mr. Odell Beckham Jr.
More sports.
More sports. Is this the sports cast now?
Oop-de-oop.
Oop-de-oop, baby. Yeah. Bringing it back.
Yeah.
Have you guys both been following this story?
Peripherally, through the office and through like Slack and stuff.
I know that football's a game of yardage.
It's a game of yards? I thought it was a game of inches.
You got to move the ball.
Wait, are we doing
in Canada or here?
Are they different?
Yeah, for the record, we're talking about American football, not Canadian football.
Several downs. Well, you just got to move the chain. That's the deal.
All right, let's get people up to speed here. So Odell Beckham Jr. used to play for the New York Giants. Used to love him. Now, not on the New York Giants. Hate him. But
what team is he on now?
He's on the Cleveland Browns.
Okay. Oh,
so,
I think they're not very good.
Ooh, there's some people who work for this company who are going to be very not happy with you about
going.
That.
I keep interrupting
but,
you.
All right, so here's the basic story. So Odell Beckham Jr. gets traded from the New York Giants to the Cleveland Browns, and he goes out to buy a watch to celebrate. He buys an RM1103 McLaren, which is black and this crazy bright orange color. The Browns colors are brown and orange, kind of looks like the Browns colors, right?
Got it.
He's seen wearing it. He wears it to training camp. Everybody goes, oh, Odell got this crazy, you know, couple $100,000 watch in his new team's colors. Cool. Story seems pretty simple. Then, about 2 weeks ago, he shows up to the first game of the season, his first game on the Cleveland Browns. And he shows up wearing the watch. Everybody's like, oh, interesting. He's got the watch on the field during warmups. Then he actually wears the watch during the game.
Yeah, people were really upset about that.
People were really upset about it. And like we've seen Nadal does it.
Yeah.
Serena does it. So we've seen it in tennis. There's a couple of golfers, right, who wear watches.
Some do, yeah.
Yeah.
Some don't for the balance.
Yeah, right. Are you a golfer?
Well, you know, as of late.
Perfect. All right. We're coming back to that. But
So he wears this watch on the field. So everybody notices it's crazy. He's wearing, I think it's like a $350,000 Richard Mille in his team colors on the field. And it's all anybody wants to talk about. I mean, it's like ESPN's talking about it. Sports Illustrated's talking about it. You know, Yahoo Sport. Everybody in the sports world's talking about it. Like ABC News, the New York Post. Everybody's writing about this thing. I actually don't think I've seen so much like mainstream news chatter about watches in a long time. Have either of you guys?
No, definitely not.
Probably not since the Newman.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
That's a big splash.
Been what? Almost 2 years?
Yeah. When was that, Gray? 2017?
October 2017.
Yeah.
There we go.
Burned on the brain.
So, story seems pretty simple, right? Like, football player wears a watch on the field. Everybody notices. Like, but that's not that crazy, right?
But why did so many people notice? Was it because it was a danger to other players to be wearing the watch, or like a danger to himself? Because I felt like there was a little bit of like, oh, this is illegal.
Yeah. Blah, so the NFL, like,
Twitter was freaking out.
That watch weighs about as much as all the change in your pocket.
Right.
It's probably okay.
Yeah. Probably fine. And like the NFL, that didn't stop the NFL from being mad about it. But
they get upset about a lot about of everything. Stuff.
Yeah, I don't that's even know their that move. Much
about
right?
the sport, they like being upset.
They're mad about the wrong things. Let's just be clear.
100% Yes. True. So they're upset about this, and like they threaten to fine him, and he's like, I don't care, I'll pay the fines. Like, I'm going to keep wearing my
watches. I love my watch.
Yeah, exactly. And like, okay, fine. So by this point, it's like Tuesday after the first game of the season. This feels like the story's dead, right? It's like, Odell's wearing a watch. He's going to keep wearing a watch. Fine. Everybody paid attention. Then the second Sunday, second game of the season, he's back in New York. He's playing the Jets, not the Giants, but he's back in New York, same stadium out in Jersey. And, he shows up to warmups wearing another Richard Mille. This time he's wearing a sapphire Richard Mille. People think it was the RM5601, which is a skeletonized tourbillon, sapphire case, limited edition of 5 pieces. Like, pretty cool, pretty crazy watch. Back from like 2013, right? Like, it's an old limited edition Richard Mille. Everyone's kind of like, wait, what? Like, okay, he ends up not wearing it during the game, just during warmups. And then in the post game, some reporters are asking him about it. And, his quote, I've got it written down here. He says, I'm off of it. I don't really have any comment about it. I think Daniel Wellington might be a better watch than these. A little classier, not as flashy as this one. I'm just blessed.
Huh?
So here's where it gets weird, right? So he says this thing on Sunday night. Everybody's like, oh, what the hell's going on? Tuesday, we're recording this on Thursday. 2 days ago, our friends over at Watchonish post on Instagram that they think the watch is fake. And there's a whole bunch of close-up photos of it, photos of the real watch. This thing's fake. Like, there's basically no way, unless there's some huge confusion over these photos, which I don't think is true. The watch isn't real. It's a fake Richard Mille. And if you think about it, right, 2013, I looked this up, 2013... Odell Beckham is playing in his junior year at Louisiana State University, not making a professional football player's salary yet. Richard Mille's tend to sell out pretty quickly, and the secondary market for like $1 million, $2 million tourbillons is like not huge. How would he even have gotten this watch? There are 5 of them, and they were sold when he was in college.
Well, there's a will, there's a way, Stevie.
Okay.
Blessed.
But I will say it looked superimposed on his wrist in the picture.
He's blessed.
Very blessed.
Yeah, he's blessed. He figured it out.
All right.
But I will say, when I saw the picture for the first time, I was like, oh, okay, he's wearing a Richard.
Right. Mova. So it just gets weirder and weirder. And the first time around, when the NFL was like, oh, you can't wear the watch, whatever, it's dangerous, his response was like, yeah, it's plastic. Which, like, it's, you know, if you want to get really nitty gritty, the original.
It is plastic.
Well, the second one, yeah. The first one, presuming it's real, we don't know, but presuming it's real, is like composite, whatever. It's like quartz and carbon TPT. Like,
it is a derivative of plastic at some level, but it's some sort of a composite material that they create. I believe those models, the McLaren ones, they're a mix, depending on what part of the case structure you're talking about, of something called quartz TPT. And I could have this backwards, but I think the part that actually, the wall of the case is quartz TPT, and the flank, the back and the top where the color is carbon TPT, which allows them to get the color blend and that kind of banded wood finish.
Yeah. So all this happens. We're now at like the end of Tuesday. So we're like 9 days after this whole thing starts. And then Wednesday morning, we come into the office, and Ben has dropped into the company Slack channel a post from Daniel Wellington's Instagram account announcing that Odell Beckham Jr. is their newest brand ambassador.
Boom. Boom, boom, boom.
Those
boom,
are
boom,
all boom, the wrong mouth sounds to me. It's just the Price is Right fail sound. Bum, 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 bum. Boom.
Can we get you to do Foley for this show?
Of course, yeah. There's a day rate involved.
But if you look at the Daniel Wellington Instagram account,
yeah,
they started posting new ambassadors back on like September 10th.
Right.
And the first one was a shadow of Odell.
Interesting.
It's not his face, it's not anything, but he's got that hair, yep, right? And so the silhouette of his hair is there. So I don't think anyone in this community necessarily follows Daniel Wellington.
Right.
If you do, great. No, no, no harm, no foul. No shade. And we all should be, because clearly they're marketing geniuses and have figured it out. But I think it's kind of interesting that nobody picked up on that. And then all of a sudden he like is a Daniel Wellington ambassador. My question is, how much did they pay him to be an ambassador? Not to get tacky, but like, he's a big deal.
He is a big deal.
They've also got Kendall Jenner. They've got like a whole lineup of like real, name them. Is Taylor Swift an ambassador? I think
no,
she
I
is.
Don't think so. Bieber. Haley Baldwin, Haley Bieber.
Did you say Bieber?
They list her as Haley Bieber. Married. Yeah, because she's married. Yeah. So
it's her married name.
Just to get the date straight here. So it is September 10th that they posted his silhouette. The day he wore the first RM at the game was the 8th. So unless they're pulling stuff together real quick here, like unless they pulled this together in like less than 36 hours, like called him, got a contract signed, shot a thing that matches all the other campaigns, this is all a plan, right?
I don't think so. I think what happened was this has been under contract for a while because A, you can't get all those people in that and
right
to shoot the same kind of photograph over and over and over again like that. What happened was he probably did that to get publicity in advance.
Yeah. This is brilliant, right?
Yeah, I think it's great.
Like I can't.
I also think it's great for the watch community as a whole. Now people are talking about watches again.
What do you think, James? I want your take. Hot take. Meh. Come in hot.
I can't support anything involving Daniel Wellington.
Okay.
I'm glad that they're going to sell a few more million like junk watches. I don't know. Good for them, I guess.
It's a bold move, right? Like they essentially used.
It is or it isn't.
Assuming like, this is true, like let's be abundantly clear so that I don't like get
a lot of this is speculative.
Yeah, like
in terms of the motives and what we know to be true. Like what like I think the stuff that's easy to know is like they shot the original photos because there were other similar photos with other people. So yeah, you can probably date that back to find out who their first ambassador to step out was, and we'd be able to know the photos existed before then.
Yeah.
If we cared. But we're gonna say like the photos existed before he wore the McLaren. I think that's probably a fair shoot.
Yeah.
So maybe he knew that he wasn't going to be able to wear a McLaren on the field anymore, and he thought it'd be fun to start his season. If I was him and I had a cool McLaren that also matched my new jersey, but I also knew that I had a multi-million dollar contract with the Kmart of watch brands. And don't get me wrong, I have no problem that he's taking money from these people. Everybody should take the money that they can get. I just don't like the watches. I don't like what they represent within the community. I don't think that like I hate openly on Invicta, but I think that Invicta is an operating, still standing gateway drug to actual mechanical Swiss made, like nice appreciating watches. That's true. I feel like these are a turning point where somebody could be stepping into the pool that we swim and drown in. They feel the cool water just enough to change the temperature of their world. And they pick up one of these $60 watches and they move away thinking like, hey, look at this great watch I bought.
I actually think they're $300.
Goodness sakes.
Guys, the look of disappointment on James's goodness face sakes right now.
And they
hurts
probably
me a
cost
bit.
25 cents to make. No joke.
Yeah, I'm sure they're like $9 by the time they put a strap
on
them.
I wrote
and they
a story about Daniel Wellington back in the day. We won't dwell on this too much, but I wrote a story for Business Week back in 2015.
Yeah, that was a good story.
Thank you. I appreciate that. They didn't think so, but yeah, I wrote a story about them back in the day, and like it's actually from a business standpoint a crazy company. They went from zero to $200 million in sales in 5 years. They own their own factories. They're like completely vertically integrated. It's crazy. And like you said, like these watches must cost them next to nothing to make. And they're a marketing company. And like whatever we think of the product, which, you know, James, I'm inclined to come up closer to you on this. The marketing here is insane. Like they basically leveraged the most kind of like statusy out there, like buzzy watch brand you could, like hyper luxury, super cool, cult following, like everybody wants to be seen wearing an RM. And they leverage that to sell $300 whatever quartz watches made in China. That's a gutsy move. Like that's not something to take lightly. And like, again, to be totally clear and to make sure that, you know, I don't get calls from our, you know, COO upset that lawyers are calling, most of this is speculation. Like I have reached out to Daniel Wellington for comment. I should be hearing from them hopefully in the next like 24 hours after we're recording this. And there will have already been, by the time you're hearing this, will have already been a story on the site, which we'll link to in the show notes with any of that info. So you may actually at this point know more than we know when we're recording this. But I spoke to the folks at Richard Mille yesterday, and they politely declined to comment. They said that they have nothing to say on the matter. So
yeah.
Because yeah. It's markedly below them.
Yeah.
They just need people to buy their watches. The watch they
just
do.
Announced is like a needless sliver over $1 million. like you know when you see those numbers where you're like, this watch, the watch that it's the RM 5004 with Kimi Raikkonen, the Formula One driver, and the watch is $1,063,000, and you're like, you could make it 1-1, you could make it 1-flat. What's the 63 for?
Oh man, it drives me. We won't go too far off topic, but
pricing.
Patek does their pricing so that it's dynamic. So as currencies fluctuate, they periodically update it, and they do it as close as possible to prevent arbitrage. So like if you go to, and it's all set in Swiss francs, so they're flat numbers Swiss, and then they're not flat numbers everywhere else. So like if you go up to Tiffany here in New York and you want to go buy a Calatrava, that, or like a Nautilus, right? Like that Nautilus could be $32,651. That one would make me not buy the watch. Like, who the hell do you think you are charging that $1? Like, screw you. Come on.
I kind of, like, if it was all not zeros, I think that the $1 million sum is way more fun if it was $1,163,712. This I like way more because it sounds like a Price is Right number.
Okay.
Or like a number. Like I just don't know where they come up with the 63. I don't know how anyone prices any product. I've never tried to do this. But I feel like at a certain point, if you reach our mill, you're making 30 of something. There is a little bit of it that's just kind of like 1,063,000.
For everyone, since the magic of radio, you can't see James. James is just like shrugging and looking around the room.
They're in a boardroom. They've made this really crazy watch. They're in a boardroom and they're like, all right, well, Kimi's on board, so we're going to launch it at the Singapore Grand Prix. There's going to be a huge party. We're going to make 30 of these things. So what do you want to charge for the other 29? And they're like, well, it's got to be $1 million, right? And they're like, yeah, $1 million is fine. We got other $1 million watches, though. Have we done $1,063,000? And they're like, I don't think so. And they're like, all right, well, there's our number. Put it in the press release. And there's my final point on Richard Mille before we move on to whatever. They put their prices in the email they send us. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. If you're listening to this and you work for a watch company, just give us the price.
Every single press email I have to, sometimes you don't even read them. You just go like, Control F, $, it's not there. Reply, could I have the price in USD? Thanks, bye.
Yeah.
Like, it might as well just be an auto response.
Yeah.
If no $, or no use of CHF in text.
This is another reason I'm gonna give Richard Mille some props, not just because they give us the price, but because Richard Mille does not generally do price upon request, despite the fact that their watches are hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars.
Yeah.
My personal take, if you're not willing to publicly say the price of your product, that tells me you're embarrassed at how much you're charging for your product.
Or you haven't made the decision for the $63,000.
Price upon request, they just throw a dart at a board when you call.
Let's wait and see who emails.
Yeah. All right. Since by this point, the readers probably know more than we do, let's call it...
Story in development.
Yeah, story on development. We're going to call the OBJ chat.
TBD. Before we move on, I have one question for the three of you.
All right.
If you're playing a professional sport, so if Cara is playing golf, Stevie's playing hockey?
Yeah,
I think
sure.
I'd rather play tennis.
James is curling.
Wantonly or? Too tall F1 driver. Yeah, there we go.
What watch are you wearing?
Ooh.
I want to switch my sport to tennis, though.
Okay.
Tennis is a pretty cool sport.
I would take the Rafa RM because I also need to be lightweight.
Heck yeah, that's a good watch.
But I would make it Sapphire.
Am I allowed to pick the same watch?
Please no.
Okay.
But mine's Sapphire. It's a made up watch.
I don't want to add any weight to my.
Yes.
I don't want to add any weight to my Formula One car.
Yeah. You don't need it with those cars. They're so heavy.
Yeah. Plus, I eat so many like hamburgers. You gotta take the weight off where you
can. I was gonna say, James. The deal is, you order one double animal style and wear the watch.
I could wear eight watches if I just cut back on In-N-Out.
Who's the one who talks about that in auto racing? Is it the guy who works at Porsche?
Andreas Breuninger, who runs RS for Porsche. He's like, the clients are so crazy about shaving ounces off of a car. He's like, just go on a diet. Like at a certain point, it's so much work to cut, say, 20 pounds out of a car, especially like an RS, like a car they've already, like, it doesn't have door handles, has a little piece of nylon to close the door. Like, it's light.
Yeah.
You could lose 20 pounds. Car will go a little bit faster if you're that worried about it. I mean, these are the guys that, like, they'll check the box to not have air conditioning in the car because it weighs X number of pounds for the air conditioning system. It's just crazy.
All right, you can leave your watch in the pit.
Yeah, solid gold, Royal Oak. It's the same answer for anything I'm ever going to do. I want a really early solid gold, yellow gold Royal Oak with the gray dial.
Should we crowdfund this?
No, it's not a worthwhile thing to crowdfund.
Leave us a comment on the post if you would contribute towards James's solid gold Royal
Oak. If you would, take the amount of money in your mind and give it to a charity. I do not need said watch. I want it badly. I don't need it.
All right, I'm going to go with an RM2. I'm going to go with the 6702, which is the sprinting watch.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
So they do it in the Johann Blake colors. They do it in...
a blue-red for a French dude.
They do it in the blue-red, and that's the one I would take.
It's pretty cool.
I'm a diehard... Everybody who listens to the show probably knows this by now. I'm a diehard New York Rangers fan. Season's about to start. Really excited. So I'd have to go with the blue-red and white one for that. But it's slim. It would fit under a glove nicely. It'd be easy. All right. So the OBJ story is still developing. Watches and sports. RM seems like the overwhelming favorite.
Mm-hmm.
We'll check back in on this. I think there's going to be more to this story.
We've been talking a lot about watches and sports lately.
Yeah. You're a sports lady now.
I guess.
Sorry.
We like sports. We don't care who knows.
Yeah, fine.
Oop-de-oop.
James is moving chains. You're doing oop-de-oops. Yeah. We got everybody.
I think Odell did the biggest oop-de-oop of all.
We gotta make that like an official slogan.
Gray's rolling
for you.
His eyes right now.
We gotta like trademark that for you. Oop-de-oop.
It's a real thing.
Okay.
Giphy said so.
Oh, that's true. It did. All right. Sweet. Thanks for doing this, guys. This was fun. And everybody, we'll leave the links to any relevant stories down in the show notes. And I have a funny feeling this isn't over. Carl looks so upset about that.
Bum bum ba bum.
Next up, my conversation with Suit Supplies Nish DeGruyter. Thanks so much for joining us. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
We got connected actually through Mark Cho, right? From the Armory.
Yes.
I feel like it's funny. I feel like I've known about you and Suit Supply for a long time, and it's kind of crazy that we haven't met until now. Kind of running in the same orbit. But
I know. And a lot of guys that's been on your podcast, like, I know him, and like, hey, this guy. And
it's a good community in that
absolutely.
Way, though, right? Yeah.
Absolutely. It's actually... The fun part is that when we just started out here in 2011, I had when there was the internet was still up and coming, I met this group of guys who called themselves the internet, the hashtag menswear guys.
Oh man, hashtag menswear days.
Exactly, those guys. And I'm like, okay, you And then I start to dive in more a bit. And then that's the moment I started to know Sean Hodgkins and Jeremy. I met him and like all these, all the guys who were Gian. And remember that those days? Like it was fun. Like they're all like roaming around Soho writing about Stell. And
yeah. I remember when that all started, I'm going to date myself here, but I was still in college and I had a menswear blog at the time. I was super into it. I knew that that's what I wanted to do, but I wasn't in New York. I was in the Midwest. I was in St. Louis and then Chicago.
Yeah.
And I remember just like, you see these photos of these guys roaming around Soho all with like, you know, the Mismo backpacks.
Yes.
And like, it was like a very particular look at that time.
Yeah.
And I was just like, man, someday I'm going to get there.
And
that was a really interesting time kind of in the evolution of menswear on the internet.
Absolutely. Because when we just started here on the corner in Soho with a second floor space, and we were like, how do we get our name out there? And what do people follow? And who do people read?
Yeah.
And those were the early days when the Instagrams were up and coming, and when you had 3,000 followers, you're like, oh, you're a big guy.
Yeah, that was huge. That's the thing,
huge. So but we had people coming in into the store with those Instagram handles or Tumblrs, like, hey, I want to look like this. Do you have something like this? So instead of the magazines, or instead of the people, brought in their moms. And their mom, like, your dad wearing a suit like this, so you gotta wear it like that as well. Like, no, I wanna wear it like this.
Yeah.
And then you saw the pictures from PT and from all these big bloggers, or you saw, Tommy Tan,
Were the days where like the coolest thing you could possibly do was get photographed by Scott Schumann, Tommy Tan, or Justin Chung.
Absolutely.
Like, if one of those three guys took your picture and put it on the internet, you were done.
Yeah. That was the holy grail. It was like, what?
It was incredible.
Exactly.
It's also funny because, like you said, at that time it was Tumblr. Like it wasn't, this is pre-Instagram. Everybody had Tumblrs.
Tumblrs.
And then there was, I think we've talked about this on the show before, and then there was Fuck Yeah Menswear, which was a huge thing.
Yes. You're right about that.
And everybody wondered who it was and then found out it was Lawrence the whole
Lawrence
time.
Lawrence Lossman.
Yeah.
Yeah. What a guy. Exactly.
He's amazing. I mean, he's running Grailed right now, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is pretty incredible.
But still, the whole, that group, like, people are still like, they do pretty decent and pretty good for themselves, right? Everybody is still doing cool stuff. And
It's cool that this whole generation of young guys who were all really into clothes and style and craftsmanship were all able to kind of like hit it at the right time as the internet was becoming super mainstream, and as, you know, fashion on the internet was becoming mainstream. And they all found ways to make careers out of it.
Absolutely.
And all like followed their passions.
And we didn't know in the beginning that we thought about who will buy a suit on the internet.
Right.
Like and then I heard from a lot of corners in the industry, like, focus on your online business. It's going to be a thing. And people are very confident in buying something online. I'm like, but who will buy a suit online? I said, you'll be surprised. And, and you know, truth be told, it's one of our biggest growing businesses we have.
That's wild.
It's 35% of our business is online.
35%. Yeah. Wow. That's actually really, that is surprising to me. I mean, I buy everything online, but I don't think I bought a suit online.
I know, but it's also convenient that you buy it. I see a lot of guys buying two or three suits.
Okay.
In different sizes. It's free returns. Like it's
okay.
They get handy in it.
Okay.
But it's also fun to track, and that's a whole different discussion, but to see the bloggers or the influencers who are buying our product and then shooting and then returning it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And some of the biggest out there, and they don't tag you. But you see, these guys, you can see the name. Like we run on full Salesforce. So you can see, you have some insight there.
That's really funny. Wow. That's like a real thing that happens a lot, or it's just
you wouldn't be surprised if that a lot of people do that. They just buy it, shoot content, and then return it.
That's super funny. I would never have guessed.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you guys came to New York for the first time in 2011, right?
Yes. So
okay,
I used to intern at Cucinelli.
Okay.
In Italy, and I was working in Solomeo for a while, and then one day I met the president from Cucinelli in Solomeo, and he's like, "What the hell are you doing here?" in like a thick American accent. He's like, yeah, I work, I do an internship, I'm trying to learn some Italian. And he's like, you got to come with me to New York because that suits you better than Solomeo. I'm like, all right, I've never visited New York. I've never been here. And so you go one day, and within 2 or 3 months, I was moving from Solomeo, where there's a couple of thousand people living, to New York City. A
little bit different.
That was like, what? That was like a moment for myself that it was so crazy. Like, you come into the city, and then working for Cucinelli was amazing experience, and traveled around the United States, opening shops and built up menswear brand. And I remember one day I had a wedding from a friend that I met, and I lost my suitcase on the West Coast. So I asked the guy, hey, where can I find a decent suit that wouldn't break the bank? Because, you know, Cucinelli stuff was always out there.
Yeah, it's not something you like impulse buy when your suitcase gets lost.
Yeah, exactly. And then I went to J. Crew and I went to a bunch of other different brands, and I couldn't find something that was fit properly, that had the right aesthetics, that did tailoring on the spot, and it wasn't there. And that day I was like, hey, the guy who started Suit Supply in Holland, he should come to, we should bring this to the United States. And I met him on the PT.
Okay.
And he's like well known, of course, in Holland for what he built back then. And, you know, we started to talk, and, you know, it's when you start a business together and you start dating a little bit, and he came to New York a couple of times and he saw the business with Cucinelli we built. And then one day we found the right spot here in Soho on Broome Street. It was a second floor store. There were apartments and there was a grocery store downstairs. I don't know if you remember Gourmet Garage.
Yeah.
and with the stairs, steep staircase, and, you know, we'll start it. And then we opened our first door, and it was quite interesting. Like that you know, in the industry, when you were at the Cucina, at the beautiful hill, and then they're like, oh, why are you going to Suit Supply? It's crazy. I'm like, trust me, it is so nice. It is a nice product. It is. And I believe in it. And I felt it, that there was an opportunity for something that was not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
And
at that time, though, Suit Supply was already successful.
It was also successful. They had a big business in Holland, in London, in Belgium. Yes,
I was going to say, because I think the first time I encountered Suit Supply was maybe 2009 in London.
Yeah, correct.
Just the shop right off. Yeah, right off Savile Row, and I remember. I think I bought something there and then came back here and was like, oh, I want to go get another jacket, and couldn't. Yeah. It wasn't here. And I was like, oh, wait. Like, I had no idea that it wasn't already global. It kind of felt like something that should be. So it's not that surprising to hear that, like, you got here and were like, oh, yeah, like, this should exist here, obviously. Exactly.
It's so crazy. Think about that back in the day. And it was, we started with one store.
Right.
And so.
And now how many do you have in the U.S.?
In North America, so Canada, we have 45 stores.
Okay, wow.
So it's coast to coast, all the major cities. We have Toronto, of Montreal. We have Mexico City.
Okay.
So all the, from Vegas, LA, St. Louis.
Okay. Man, St. Louis, I could have used that like 12, 13 years ago. Yeah, that would have been nice.
St. Louis, yeah. It's actually doing decent business there.
Really?
Yeah.
That's cool. That's good to hear.
Yeah.
So... you started in 2011, you opened the door, and kind of what was the reception like? Like, again, this was like the heyday of online menswear. Like, correct. Did people kind of welcome you with open arms? Or
in the beginning, the beauty, we were lucky that the Wall Street Journal did a blind testing on suits. And we had to submit a suit, take the labels out, and there were two FIT professors who were just cutting it up and look at that quality. And it was Hugo Boss, Armani, Jaco, like a bunch of people submitted a suit. And then one day, like a week later or 2 weeks later, I think, it became front page news on the Wall Street Journal that Suit Supply got voted number one next to an Armani $3,500 suit.
Not bad.
On the off-duty section, like a full pager.
Not bad at all.
And then we had lines. In front of the, like,
really?
Basically, yeah, it was crazy. And that got us an instant stamp of recognition. And people just came from all over New York to come visit us. And from Chicago, D.C., people came in and they just, hey, what's that suit supply all about? What the word got out, and the first guy who actually supported our business hard was Jim Moore. Mm-hmm. Like, and I knew him from the Cuccinelli days. Well, yeah. All the other editors were like, they didn't want to mess around with Suit Supply, and Jim Moore was the first guy who was like,
you got. And for people who may not know, Jim Moore was the creative director of GQ for like decades. He's a legend.
He's absolutely legend, and I can't thank him enough for supporting us that well. And then we had Mark Anthony Green, who was working for Will Welch, who was all the whole GQ team came in and gave us love, and they, you know. Then Matt shot a portrait from Suit Supply.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was on the podcast as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he came in. And so it became such a thing. And slowly, we were in the zone. It was just excited. And we just made nice products and people were supporting us. And yeah, we are very lucky that we got adapted in the menswear industry, and especially not because of course we had good relationships and whatnot, but it all comes down to product and doing something different, being disruptive. We don't take ourselves too serious, mm-hmm. and we have fun doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that I've always really liked about Suit Supply is it's fun. It doesn't take itself too seriously. No. It feels young. But the, like you said, the craftsmanship is there.
Absolutely.
Like the objective quality of the product is there.
It's key.
And they're really at those price points. Most of what you get is, to be honest, it's crap. Like it's just glued together. You're getting, you know, everything's machine stitched. It's really not even the stuff where, you know, I think a lot of brands have smartened up, but like, you know, they put the like faux functioning buttonholes and it's like, it's all these things that make it look like it's quality. But like you then look at the buttonhole and it was like, sewed on and punched out with a stamp. And like, how do you guys try to balance those things and make sure that you can offer that kind of quality without the prices getting crazy?
We never cut corners in our product. And if you think about a traditional retail model, like the big boxes, there is a manufacturer or a brand. Then the brand has an agent. Then the agent goes to another agent overseas. And then there is a department store or a specialty store. So before the product hits the store, there are four people who are making a cut. And when it hits the store has buys full page ad spreads. They have a very large executive board that needs to fly first class all over the world and attend trade shows and whatnot. And so at the end, the prices for all that is going back into the product and the consumer pays for it.
Yeah.
And then they have very expensive big stores that they pay Fifth Avenue rent or... So all these prices are getting amortized back into the product and the final consumer pays for it. So in our model, which is vertically integrated, we design, manufacture, we do everything in-house. And then we buy our fabrics in Italy at the big mills, the Barberes, Ferla, Loro Piana, Zegna, and then we'll ship it to our factory and from our factory straight to the store. And if you see our stores, they're always a bit more off the beaten path. So we're not on Broadway, but we are just right off Broome on the second floor. So that saves us a bunch of rent. And well, instead of spending the money on ads and all that stuff, we just spend money on developing a very nice product. Mm. And our value proposition, like it's... you get a very high quality product at an attainable price point because there's all these other things are not being, you know, calculated back into the we don't have those expenses.
Yeah.
And we can create a bigger floor print for a nicer experience. And think about a suit is never an impulse buy.
Right.
You're not roaming the street like, oh, let's buy a suit today. Right. So you have a very designated customer.
I know some people who might do that.
You might do that, exactly. Yeah. After brunch.
Yeah, that probably speaks to my weird friends, but yeah.
But it's at least you have the, you know, they come in, they get a suit, they are surprised with the service and the guys, like you can sell a suit from any range price, but if the guy who sells you the suit and who doesn't put the pins on the right spot, who doesn't tailor it well, it still looks like crap. So what we do is we train all our guys who are working with us in our internal suit school, which is based in Dallas. It's a 2-week training on how to pin, but also how to style, what to wear, what not to wear, how to polish your shoes, like just the basics. And all that together makes it into a very fun experience. And we do the tailoring on site for the basic alterations while you wait, because it shouldn't take that long. And guys are also not guys who are plan ahead. Like, oh, I have a wedding in a few days. Like, I need something. Like, he just told me, like, I got a wedding coming up next week.
Yeah.
And so it's, women plan it months in advance. Guys don't do that. So
yeah. Full disclosure, I guess it was 2 years ago, the day we flew out, our team flew out to SIHH in January, I realized I had packed too many pairs of pants. And I literally walked around the corner, bought a pair of pants, had them hemmed, and put them in my suitcase and went to the airport.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, and that happens every day.
Because you'd think with the amount I pack, I would know how to pack, but turns out I have no idea.
But that's all guys struggle with that. And that's, you know, to do that and to offer that service is just something new. People start talking about it. And, you know, that's how we capture the market and slowly became a bigger thing.
What would you say are the sort of like technical and construction things that for you are the most important things that set your jackets or a quality suit apart from
stuff? We work with 100% natural fabrics, fibers in this case. So we work with nice mills. And then everything in the interior is a floating canvas. So a canvas is something, it's like the heartbeat of the suit. So if you don't have something that's canvased, it doesn't give it shape. So it's made from camel and horse hair. So think about a hair shapes back in its original shape. So it gives its suit its fit. And if something is glued, you cannot pull in the side seams and make sure it fits. Then you get a boxy look. That's where the word boxy comes from. It's also over time when you dry clean it, it holds the shape better. You know, it's something that's made with soul. And I think if you look closer to our product, you see that people looked at it. It's not just made. There's the buttonholes, the density of the yarn, the boat shaped breast pocket, the molten, like the after dinner spit on the pants. I can talk about for hours about that stuff, but that makes it nice and that sets us apart. And
it's funny because hearing you talk about a suit, I mean, I got my start in the menswear world. And so when I'm looking at watches, I still always have that in the back of my mind. And it's funny hearing you talk about the construction of a suit, it doesn't surprise me at all that you're a watch guy. Like it feels natural. It's that same sort of attention to detail, but like not just for its own sake. Like
exactly.
It has to kind of like give you something too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Were you interested in clothes first and watches first? Did they kind of come together?
Came together.
Okay.
It came absolutely together. Like I got excited about watches when I was working in a restaurant.
Okay.
In Holland. And the manager there, who's like my mentor in the early days in life, said he got me excited about watches. And he's like, you know what, Nies? If you see the guy with a certain watch, you know, you can already envision what they're going to order in drinking.
Interesting.
And you can also see what kind of car they drive. And then he, every time when he walked in, oh, there's a guy with a vintage Rolex. He was driving a Defender. And then he was ordering a craft beer. So, you know, and then you had the guys with the golden Rolex came in for Bacardi and Coke, and they drove a Mercedes-Benz, you know? So, and
in Holland, pretty accurate, like, yeah.
You had that, you can really put everything together. And then over time, it became just a hobby and just to, you know, find out what he's going to drink.
And now a look at this week's sponsor. By the time you're hearing this, I'm sorry to say, summer's going to be officially over. Monday, September 23rd is the autumnal equinox, marking the transition to fall. If you're feeling a little nostalgic though, you're in luck. As part of its US exclusive Seasons collection, Grand Seiko is offering the SBGH 271, a watch representing the summer season to keep the warm weather vibes flowing. The watch's 40mm stainless steel case is paired with a matching steel bracelet, and powering the watch is the Caliber 9S85, which is a high-beat automatic movement with a 55-hour power reserve. The watch is classic Grand Seiko through and through. What sets this special edition apart, though, is the deep forest green dial. It has a subtle texture that really only comes out when it catches that perfect summer light.
Complementing the dial are faceted yellow gold indexes and hands, adding an extra touch of warmth. The watch is elegant without being fussy, and despite being inspired by a beautiful Japanese summer, it'll look awesome year-round. For more about the Seasons collection and Grand Seiko's other families of watches, visit GrandSeiko.com. All right, let's get back to the show. So did you have a moment then where you were like, okay, I got to get a watch now? Like this
100%.
What was that watch for you?
He was wearing the Pepsi dial, and I needed to have that watch, you know. And it was so cool. But it was, you know, back then I got to work. And he said, you know, for your birthday, I will give you your first watch. And that was a Techno Marine.
Okay. Yeah.
Like that you can change those bands, but it was really, it worked in the environment and it worked for my style back then.
Cool.
And then slowly I was saving money for one day I would get that Pepsi dial.
And did it happen?
Oh yeah, it happened.
Yeah?
No, it took a few years. But
that's amazing. That's great though.
It happened.
What was it like when you got that and you got to like put it on for the first time?
You have no idea.
Yeah.
Like I had it on. I tried all my outfits to see what it worked. and then the internet became bigger and bigger. So you start researching the reference numbers, and then you're gonna dive a bit deeper in it.
Yeah.
And then you get into a rabbit hole about movements.
Oh
yeah. And then you start collecting books, and you ordering your own kit to open it up. And he's like, "Do never open your own watch up. Do never." But
And so what year? When would that have been?
I was 24, 23, 24. I had my my first 23rd, like right before I moved to Italy.
Okay.
Because the Italians and watches is not the vintage watch in Italy is.
Yeah.
It's so fun. I remember that. I still have the watch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you
yeah.
wear it all the time?
Yeah. So every once in a while.
That's awesome.
I break it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did your watch collecting kind of evolve from there?
Oh, but like it becomes obsessive.
Of course.
Because you're gonna roam the internet. And I think the pleasure of researching is almost better than owning it.
It's funny. You're not the only person I've heard say that. And probably even on this show, if I think about it, is like the hunt is a
the
big
hunt.
Part of what makes it special.
Exactly. Because I remember when I had that, the Pepsi, the GMT, and a week later I was looking at what's the next watch?
Yeah.
What's the next watch going to be? And then what's the thing I'm going to do? And like researching. And then for me back then was like the holy grail was the AP, the offshore. Because I saw a guy in a restaurant back then. He had it on the Kevlar strap. It was the coolest guy in Holland. And AP was the thing.
Yeah.
And still.
Yeah, there's still is. I like, mean, yeah.
And then, you know... got that eventually, like saved up some money for the AP, and then I swapped it into rose gold one, and then you know you just started to it gets big, like the more like even like you always look at things you can't afford,
yeah,
and then you can, and then you're like fuck, you know the next one is
now
the Patek,
do the next
it
one
is the Patek 5980, like that's and then I remember very well, like I saw that for the first time on a guy in Greenwich. I had the 5980 on a nice brown strap, like whoa. And then you start opening the Patek into the Patek world and the books and there's so much to read about it.
Yeah.
And the history made me even want to have it more. And that was before the Patek, like the Nautilus hype. It was still like back then you could buy a 5980 for 30. Like it's a lot of money. I don't get me wrong. But it was still decent. It was fair pricing.
And you could get one.
You could get one.
I mean,
one.
The thing is now, even if you have the cash in hand, you probably can't
forget
get one.
Forget it.
Yeah.
Forget it. Trust me. I think about back in the day, like, and it's not, it's like 6-7 years ago. Not
right.
Not that long ago.
It's not that long.
No. Where it was all reasonable and, but you know, you buy something, you sell something, and then I wanted to mess around with like, yeah, got excited about Richard Mille.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you got that Mille. You know, that's a whole different league you're entering.
That is a whole other ballgame. Yeah.
Exactly. And then I got my hands on the RM11. And then I had it and I hated it so much.
Really?
Yeah.
Why? What about it?
There was nothing, I think at the end, I'm like, I just wanted to like accomplish that I could afford a Miele, but it was, and of course it's beautiful and it's, but the joy that I had with the Pepsi dial or with a nice AP, I didn't got that when I had the RM 11.
Interesting. Like, so you got rid of it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you find
also, I couldn't tell my wife. Like,
that's one you have to keep secret. Exactly. Yeah, for sure. that's one you don't talk about.
Exactly. But it was fun, but I had it, I think, not even a month.
Do you cycle your watches a lot? Do you find, sometimes, like, you buy something, sell something, or is it?
I have a few pieces that I really keep, the APs I had, like, I keep the really statement pieces.
Okay.
But then sometimes you got excited about, like, I have a beautiful Duomètre which I love, but, and I find out I never wear it. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, but I looked at it, I think, 100 times before I bought it. Yeah. And in the shop, I'm like, wow. And then at the end, like, I never wear it. Mm. So what are you going to do? Like, you're going to sell it? And then I'm like, right now, I'm looking at a 5170 Patek.
Okay.
And like, it's... And then you think like you're going to scrape money together. And you're like, you see, yeah.
You start doing the game. Like, okay, what do I have to sell to buy this? And exactly. If I buy this, what can't I buy? Yeah. And is this going to go up? It's like you're constantly playing this like game in your own head.
Exactly.
Yeah. And which becomes, I think we all at the office here know very well.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
It sounds like your watch tastes also skew more towards sport watches, which is funny because you're usually wearing a suit and tie.
Yes.
Do you like something about wearing sport watches with a suit?
Yes, 100%. Like what I like to wear with a suit is that the unexpected.
Okay.
Like, and I will go into a little deeper why I choose this watch, because I think a lot of my friends, guys, like it's a Rolex is just like you're gonna save money for it, and when you have it, you have it. But what are you gonna wear in between? Mm-hmm. Like, and I think the more dressed up you are, I think it's nicer to just mess around with different watches that fits your personality. Mm. And I think a watch should never be louder than your personality. And if you wear it in the right way, I'm like, oh, that's cool. Like, I like to wear a gold Royal Oak with a t-shirt and jeans and a pair of sneakers. That works. But if you wear a blue suit all dressed up and you have another gold watch, like, then you take yourself, I personally think, a little bit too serious. Mm-hmm. And I made that mistake too. Like, you look at me. It becomes more of a thing that, like, a lot of guys ask me, like, Nies, what kind of watch do you recommend? And then, like, I think this Vostok is a hidden gem.
Yeah. That's a watch nerd watch. Like, yes. That's something, like, you walked in with that and I was like, oh, okay, this guy's deep.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
So tell us a little bit about that watch.
So this is a Russian diver, and it's made, I think, in the Second World War for like divers. I read the story on actually you guys were the first guys that I read about this.
Okay,
back in 11 or 12, you guys did a whole article about this watch.
We'll see if we can find. I'm wondering if we can link that up. We'll try to dig it up. We'll see if we can find that story.
And I read it, and at the end, $69. I'm like, I need to get this watch. So I scouted out the internet. And I found it on, it comes out of Russia on eBay. And I'm walking around with this watch, and literally everybody that I chat with, and I know the guy in Sydney, remember that? The guy in Sydney, he's like, wow, what kind of watch is that? It looks so good. And it has weight to it. The dial is good. It has the plexiglass. You put it on the NATO strap because the original strap doesn't look good.
Okay.
So you have to take the strap off and throw like a good NATO on it. But even the crown, like the whole, it's just, it's a watch.
Yeah. How does your collection sort of shake out between vintage and modern? Do you do both?
I have two vintage watches, two Rolexes. And other than that, it's modern. I wear, when I do a tuxedo, I wear this $25 Swatch. I have a lot of Swatch, like old Swatches.
Okay.
Like the colorful ones. And I brought actually my favorite one with me.
Because perfect.
You guys... Because it's always easy to talk about Patek and APs and all the expensive stuff, but like like this one.
This is cool. We'll have a photo of this. If you if you want to see this watch, you should go look at the story that goes with this podcast on Hodinkee. This is awesome.
And I wear this with a tuxedo.
Really?
And
that's cool.
Literally everybody asks me like, what kind of watch is that? And it's a good conversation piece.
Yeah.
And I got this from an artist in Holland that you know, gave it as a gift. And you know, I have a bunch of them from my father-in-law and... My dad gave me a first Swatch, like the Flick Flock.
Yeah, yeah.
And so those are like, they're monumental pieces. And I think if you can pull this off in the right way, like that's the cool factor.
Yeah, I mean, this is with a tuxedo, this is a blue Swatch with a white dial that has yellow and blue and red and green on it. And the strap is white with like spaceships and Saturn and stars all over it. Like, this is not a quiet quiet watch.
But if you wear it in a very serious look, it works. And then, of course, if you want to wear like a vintage Patek or whatever, then that's expected.
That's true. Yeah.
But to do this is like, everybody will start a conversation about that.
Yeah, it's true.
So... That's what I like. And then with cotton suits, I like to wear NATO straps.
Mm-hmm.
With more wool suits, I like to wear leather. Like, it depends on the weather as well outside. If it's too sweaty out, you don't want to wear a leather watch strap.
Yeah, agreed.
So, yeah.
How do you think watches factor into kind of dressing more broadly? Like, how should guys think about the way that watches factor into how they get dressed?
Good question. Like, I think it's a big misconception that a watch makes the outfit.
Mm.
Because it's like, if it doesn't work for your personality again, it doesn't work for your style, it doesn't look good. It's the same like a woman who wears high heels but can't walk on it.
Mm.
It doesn't look good, you know? Doesn't matter how expensive the shoes are, it's the same with the watch. And that's how I felt with the Richard Mille. Like, it didn't work for me. That's a big misconception. And of course, a watch can make a whole outfit, but it needs to work for the person and the style. You know, it's...
And so whether it's watches or the suit you're wearing or the other clothing you're wearing or your shoes, you think it's really about kind of finding what works for you?
Correct.
Okay.
And also because, of course, it needs to work for your budget as well, but it also needs to work. Like, it's not that... the same thing with that, what I told earlier about the guy with the AP offshore with the Kevlar strap worked for that guy.
Yeah.
And when I had it on my wrist, it looked completely ridiculous.
Yeah, I could not pull off an offshore on a Kevlar strap. I would look like an idiot.
Exactly. But you know what I mean? Like, and if you look at the Schwarzenegger it works for these guys.
Yeah.
Or the End of Days. Like, it works for, like, it needs to work for... If you see like, oh, you're a vintage kind of guy, you would drink a gin tonic, you know, like it's, you know, it works. And yeah, it's hard to explain, but it's sometimes you see for people what works and what doesn't work. Like, it's the same if one guy comes into our store, it's like, hey, I need a powerful suit. Okay. So what does that mean, a powerful suit? Does that mean a loud suit? It's like, I don't know. And then they grab the heavy pinstripe. Like, is this your first suit? He says, yeah, it's my first suit. Like, no, you don't want to become the guy in the pinstripe suit.
Right.
And that suit will wear you instead of the other way around. It's like, you want to a powerful suit is a suit that's tailored well, that you feel comfortable in and confident. And then, and that's the same thing that you can relay back on the watch game. Like, if you wear a gold Rolex or whatever, 1620, doesn't work. If it doesn't work for your personality,
because
then, you know,
it's funny.
You know,
I mean,
what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, it's funny because talking about the loud, like, you don't want to be the guy in the pinstripe suit, right? It makes me think of what we were talking about earlier with the kind of, you know, heyday of hashtag menswear, where like everybody wanted the loudest plaid and the widest tie. And it was about like the kind of brashest, most like in your face thing that you could possibly do to get your photo taken at Pitti. Yeah.
Peacocking.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It was peacocking in the truest sense. And it feels like now, you know, if we set aside the streetwear stuff that's going on. Like the guys who are still interested in tailoring and kind of more classic menswear, it's kind of gone the opposite now, right? It's like you see what the guys at like Sam and Amel are doing, and like it's so understated. It's almost all detail. Yeah. Like there's no
loud screaming.
It's nothing loud. It's all about details. Yeah. It's all about construction. It's all about cut. Everything's like beige or brown or navy. It's totally the opposite.
Good quality, beautiful fabrics, well tailored, great buttons. Like it just works. Like the armory guys know, they know it as nobody else.
100%. Yeah.
And the tie is like, shit, that's good.
Yeah.
You know, you don't need to wear all of the accessorizing, like it doesn't, and you can see if somebody wears a suit every day or he does it only for PT and he's like getting all spiffy and stuff, like that doesn't work. And I think that's the same in the watch game.
Yeah, it is.
Like your first watch is never, maybe some case, but it's never a full gold watch. It's not your first watch.
Yeah.
You go into it.
And like you said, like if it is your first watch, people can tell.
Yeah.
Like people can tell that you seem kind of uncomfortable. It's like you said, when you see a guy who doesn't wear suits or sport coats often, wearing one, you can see they're kind of like uncomfortable and they're shifting and it's, but nobody, I mean, it doesn't matter how beautiful the suit is. Like nobody looks good when you look uncomfortable, right? So it's got to kind of, it's got to work.
Yeah. Same with the watch.
Do you think the kind of trend toward focusing on more kind of like details and craftsmanship and being comfortable and kind of like expressing yourself in maybe a more low-key kind of way is just a trend? Or do you think that's sort of the evolution of where we kind of came from?
I think everybody goes to the period that they think they know it all and you get very confident and you read about it and you think you want to show off and you do well in life. And that's the moment you want to like, oh, bring it. I want to, you know, I'm going to have a gold watch. Like, and then once you grow up, you know, you get married, you get kids. You're like other things in life matter more than you know. So I think some cases, or people are always, I also know guys who are consistently always luxe and never have to scream louder or whatever. They always say consistently good in their style and their watch game and whatnot. And, you know, guys go to these phases. And I'm definitely, I made so many mistakes. I'm still making mistakes, but I know exactly what I did wrong and if I could change a few things in the past, I know exactly what I would change.
What's the, because I have plenty of these too. I could talk about these for hours, clothing mistakes. I bought some truly stupid pieces of clothing over the years and ones that I paid a lot of money for, put a lot of time into. But what's the piece of clothing that looking back, you're just like, what the hell was I thinking? Like, why did I buy that?
Oh shit, I have a couple of suits.
All right. Yeah.
Scarves, like wild scarves, like plaids. Like I have a gray oversized camel checker from Fairla that was so loud that I'm like, why? And that's, again, that comes with like, you want to get comfortable and confident in a loud suit.
Yeah.
But then you see that picture, like I was not comfortable in that suit.
No.
So, or then I try to squeeze myself. I keep telling me, oh, I'm still a 38, so I'm trying to squeeze myself into a size 38, but I'm actually a 40. You know, and that's bad.
Yeah, it doesn't look good. It
doesn't look good.
Yeah, like, I think if people take one thing away from this episode, it should be don't buy your suit a size too small.
No. And I heard all the time, I will buy it because I'm going to lose weight. Don't do it. You wish you not.
Yeah.
Maybe you do, but then you come back and don't buy anything. So don't buy anything that's too small.
Yeah.
And sometimes I like to push it with my short pants, but sometimes I'm like, oh, I need you to look ridiculous, man, with these short pants. Like,
yeah. I do that. I mean, you can tell we're both doing the same thing here. Yeah, it happens occasionally. I'll like catch a glimpse of myself in a mirror and I'm just like, oh, these are too short.
Too
this
short.
Is not, this is not a good move. I look like an idiot, but yeah, it's all right.
But no, it's cool. You learn as you go. And I think if you have people around you who can give you feedback and like, hey,
yeah,
it's good. Like curating a good group around you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's one of the things that I think when I kind of moved from the menswear world into the kind of adjacent watch world made me feel kind of at home immediately was it's very much the same sort of culture of like everybody's talking to each other. Everybody's kind of bouncing ideas off of each other, experimenting, sharing experiences, kind of like, oh yeah, like I found this one cool thing. Like you should check that out. Oh, I don't think that's right for you. Yeah. Like everybody's kind of sharing all the time, which makes it much easier to learn.
Cool, right?
Yeah.
Wow. But the same with the excitement you get about watches. This is what I get too with like, I remember, like I heard not too long ago, like Jack's podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And he talked about the watch that he brought to life.
Yeah.
That excitement in his voice, like, I brought that back from 120 years ago. He brought that back to life.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, that's the same thing. If you, and not bring anything back to life, but to see wool from a sheep in Australia. Yeah. And that goes into a wash. And then you see people making a piece of article out of raw product. And the whole process in becoming a suit that's super 150 or super 200. And the craftsmanship that goes into it and becomes something that you can wear. That's so beautiful.
Yeah.
That is spectacular.
And then you guys get the experience also then of watching somebody walk out the door in it. Right?
Oh my God.
Like somebody, it makes somebody's day. Like somebody is so excited to then walk out the door.
I think the most excited thing... when we opened Suit Supply and all that, and then I was traveling, and then you see the blue garment bags on the airport. You see a guy wearing on this trolley the Suit Supply garment bag. And I always walk, if I see these guys, I always walk to them, like, hey, and like, hey, how's Suit Supply? And they all, 9 out of 10 times, like, yeah, that's a great store. And they start advocating for it.
That's awesome.
And they're like, yes, here's a gift card. So I always travel with gift cards, and when I see people wearing product, I always go up to, like, here's $50 or $25. Yeah. Like, thank you
That's
for
awesome.
Support. Yeah.
Love That's that. Cool. It's cool that you can build a community around that.
I love it.
So you travel a lot. So I gotta ask, what do you recommend guys think about when they pack?
Basic.
I think that's basic.
Keep it basic. So there's one article of clothing that you bring that brings the basic outfit into your night outfit. So I always bring a navy crew neck merino sweater, fine gauge. I bring a white t-shirt, two white t-shirts, a white button down, a navy tie, a pair of sneakers, and a pair of dress shoes. And then every time I go on the road, I throw a different article that can make or break that outfit, like that can completely change that outfit. So either a short sleeve or a long sleeve, and then I have a yellow cardigan.
Okay.
Or like then you wear your navy pants with a white shirt and then you do your navy cardigan. Or I just bring a nice hat like a Nick Fouquet's. I love Nick Fouquet hats. So I wear those hats. You do a t-shirt, neckerchief, and then just pants and a sneaker and you can make it into a whole completely different outfit.
Yeah. That guy's an artist. Nick Fouquet. He's amazing.
I look
like a dummy in hats. I can't. I've tried. I can't do it. Yeah. But that guy's stuff is amazing.
It's cool, huh?
Yeah.
I love it. But that's the stuff, like, if you have your packing, like, I made it into an art form.
Yeah.
So I never check in bags. I do carry-on only. And I try to squeeze about 5-6 days. I can do it in a carry-on and without looking the same every day.
Nice.
And I also, every time I post, when I have to check in, I always post what's in my basket. So I always tell my watch.
Yeah.
I tell my watch and like the stuff that I carry, that I travel with, and then, you know, different sneaker, different item that will spice up the outfit.
Do you have a watch or two or three different watches that tend to be your like go-to travel watches?
I have a Rolex Pro Hunter,
mm-hmm.
All blacked out, but then with a gold bezel, and it's... And it comes with a NATO yellow strap.
Okay.
And it's like, and I bring the both straps because when you wear a t-shirt and jeans, you do it with the yellow, and then otherwise you just do it with the black strap.
Nice.
And it's a very safe watch, and it's I like to wear that a lot, and I actually always like stuff with that. And then I got a rubber clad offshore.
Nice.
And I saw, like, I remember the first time when I saw that watch was in the Kanye West video.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, looked like very briefly. And I Googled, like, what was that watch? And I liked it so much. And I'm like, what? I couldn't believe that it's like the pricing. And I've really worked. I saved for a couple of years, like monthly, I made it like for that watch.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I drove, and then there was and it was, a watch dealer in Long Island.
Okay.
In Manhasset. I drove out there and I saw it.
Okay.
Like, can you hold it for me? Like, yes, and like I really come in next week, and then and I got it, and I had it the weekend, and I banged it against the elevator, and it was the first scratch.
Oof.
And I was devastated.
The first one's always the hardest.
Devastated. Right? You have no idea. Like I could have cried. I still get when I think about it. But the first ones are the hardest.
Now it's all good though.
Now it's all good.
Yeah. The best thing with those is you scratch it once, it's terrible.
Yeah.
And then when it has 100 scratches on it, it's awesome.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's how the Pepsi doll looks.
Yeah. So before we wrap things up, we always do the little Hodinkee questionnaire.
Yeah.
So I've got a couple quick questions for you. Is that all right?
Of course. Shoot.
All right. So first one is what's a watch that's caught your eye recently?
I like that new Desert Storm IWC.
Yeah, that watch is awesome.
I like that a lot. Oh, you know what I would love to have? The old Santos Santos 100.
Oh, yeah.
In gold.
That's a cool watch.
Yeah. And it's still reasonable with a brown strap. And because I saw a picture of Tom Ford in a safari shirt rocking that watch so good that I'm like, wow.
It's good enough for Tom Ford.
Yeah. It's sometimes when you see somebody wearing it with an outfit, like, whoa.
Yeah.
Cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
What's the best place you've traveled in the last year?
Oh, Sydney was phenomenal. Sydney was like the first time I went, we opened a store in Sydney, Australia.
Oh, cool.
And it was like, people are so cool, like generally cool. And then they start talking with the accent and like, wow, you're cool. And then they can just, there's something about Australians and their style. I love Pete Johnson. Like he's a menswear guy out of Australia. He nails it with his style and how he wears the product, how all his guys around him are having the Kool-Aid. Like, and I walked from Brantai to Bondi Beach. It's like a walk.
Yeah.
Tamarama. And I walked around. I saw the kids getting swimming lessons in this ocean, guys surfing. People were just being cool all day long. I'm like, wow. Yeah.
Patrick Johnson's kind of like he's kind of turned himself into like the Australian Cucinelli.
Exactly.
Where like everybody around him has a certain look and he's got like this
got
whole
the sweater,
point of view.
He's got the sweater game.
It's great.
Yeah, I know. And then he inspires me a lot, actually, when I look at outfits and when I see things, he wears it. He like the beach tailored look.
Yeah.
On a lockdown.
Yeah.
Yeah, I liked it a lot. That was a great, Sydney was actually a very good experience. But
awesome.
We're opening a store in Bogota in 2 weeks.
Oh,
like,
cool.
That would be a great experience too. Like,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
what's the best piece of advice you've ever been given and who gave it to you?
One of my mentors who helps me out a lot in the business is Gary Friedman, CEO for Restoration Hardware. And every time when I'm sitting with him, he's like, Nies, focus on one thing and become laser sharp at it. And if that's, to focus on one thing is the most difficult thing a person can do. Like if you do something well, you think you can do it all, but like if you are in a menswear, you're in the suit game, just kill in the suit game because that's where you're good at. Like don't try to mess around and reinvent shoes or reinvent women's wear or whatever. Like it's like if you have something, do it well and amp it up and just stay focused. Try it. It's so hard to stay focused on one thing and do it really well. And like I get so much energy and I get excited about things and like I'm all over the place. But
I can relate to that.
Right? You can see like if it focus on one thing at a time and just become the best at it. And that's great advice that's always sticks to me. And if I think about it, you like write a time frame, like wrote a timeline for what you want to accomplish. And stick to it. They stick it in your inside of your toilet, of your restroom. So when you look at it, you have a very clear path. So you don't dilute from it. Just focus.
Perfect.
Yeah.
What's your guilty pleasure?
As far as food?
No, anything.
Tequila.
Tequila.
I love tequila.
That's a good one.
1942.
Oh, okay. So you like good tequila.
I like good tequila.
Okay.
I drink all tequila, but that's like I think 1942 is our is a fuel. It's good stuff. I'm crazy about food and like, but my focus here is that I have to stick in my size 40 suits.
That's the thing.
If I gain too much weight, there'll be a big loss.
Yeah, that's a problem. That's the best reason to buy good clothes is because then you have to stay the
same
size.
Stick to the script. Yeah,
yeah, you're done. Exactly. You're done. Yeah. Cool. Well, we always wrap things up with a cultural recommendation. But since you said you're a food guy, I'm going to make it more specific for you.
Yeah.
What's a restaurant that you recommend people go check out?
Like one of my favorite places where I feel that I'm in the south of France is Cecconi's in Dumbo.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you sit outside with this weather, and you look at the bridges and the people strolling past, like I have a feeling I'm on holiday. Also good food, Italian food.
Yeah.
Great drinks, frozen Negronis.
Perfect.
Like it's just,
you had me at frozen Negroni.
Yeah.
I'm there.
There you go. Yeah. We'll keep it to it. We'll stick to Negroni.
We're going after this recording, right?
Perfect. You ever had a frozen Negroni?
I've not had a frozen Negroni.
It's spectacular.
I've not. I've had Quality Eats does a nitro Negroni.
Oh yeah.
It's really good. Yeah.
Oh, but
there's one over in the West Village, Upper East Side, Flatiron. There's a couple of them now.
Oh cool.
But yeah, nitro Negronis.
Nice. Oh well. That's
that'll be my recommendation. Go go to Quality Eats and check out the Nitro Negroni in New York. It's great.
Cool.
Yeah.
Oh, thanks.
Thanks so much for doing this, man. This is great.
Thanks.
And yeah, glad to have you on the show.
Cool. Well, thanks for having me. I want to talk more about Washes with you after the
show. Yeah. After we turn the mics off, we'll go pull some stuff out.
Cool.
And to bring us home, we have Joe Thompson doing what he does best, telling one hell of a story. Take it away, Joe.
Hello, gang. Stephen and Gray have kindly invited me back for another segment on Hodinkee Radio, and I'm happy to be here. In the previous one, I talked about current events, the impact of the political upheaval in Hong Kong on the Swiss watch industry. This time, I'd like to just tell a story. It's one I came across years ago and stashed in a bulging file of watch history and trivia that I keep. It's sort of a hobby of mine. Some of what's in there has to do with great moments in watch history. This isn't that. This is just a true story about a man and his watch and the strange power that watches can have over us, something that you certainly know a lot about. This guy fell in love with a watch late in life. He loved it so much that even though it was an informal watch, he wore it even on formal occasions. One day, when the watch stopped working, he was so upset that the story actually made the newspapers. Indeed, so great was his love for this watch that he requested that it be buried with him. Some of you may know the story. The man was Emperor Hirohito of Japan. And the watch was a Mickey Mouse watch. Here's their story. In 1975, when Hirohito was 74 years old, he and Empress Nagako made their first official visit to the United States. By then, Hirohito had been on the Japanese throne for 49 years. He was, of course, the emperor during World War II. The trip was intended to celebrate the strong relations between the U.S. and Japan in the 30 years since the end of the war. It was a whirlwind tour. They visited 9 cities in 14 days. One of the cities was Los Angeles, and in advance, Hirohito was asked if there was anything special he wanted to do in L.A. Well, there was. He had 2 requests. One was to meet John Wayne. The other was to go to Disneyland. So, L.A. Mayor Tom Bradley made it happen. He threw a luncheon for Hirohito with 500 guests. Among them was John Wayne. There, to his delight, the emperor met the duke. After lunch, the royal couple was whisked off to Disneyland. There, they met Mickey Mouse, and the emperor was presented with a gift, a Mickey Mouse watch. In those days, Disney character watches were produced by the Bradley Time Division of Elgin National Industries under contract with Disney. The watches ranged in price from $7 to $100. Horologically, the Emperor's watch was nothing special, other than it was quartz, which was all the rage in 1975. Nevertheless, something magical happened. Hirohito loved it. When he returned to Japan, he wore it frequently. Imperial palace officials were surprised to see that even on the most formal occasions, the Mickey Mouse watch was on his wrist. Then, in September 1978, catastrophe struck. The watch stopped. The emperor was distraught. What happened next is chronicled in the September 18th edition of Time magazine. Quoting now from the article, "There was dismay in the royal household when the trusty watch stopped ticking. Concerned palace chamberlains rushed it to Tokyo experts specializing in American timepieces. The diagnosis? A new battery was needed. Last week, his hands moving again, Mickey was reunited with Hirohito." End quote. Just as an aside, we mustn't be too hard on the emperor and his staff for not realizing the problem was just a dead battery. I was covering the industry in 1978. Analog quartz watches were just beginning to surpass digitals, and there were a lot of mistakes like that back then, and for many years after. Hirohito lived for another 11 years and wore the watch so much that it actually became associated with him. His international image was that of a quiet, reclusive man who studied marine biology and wore a Mickey Mouse watch. One example is that in France, some anti-American intellectuals pointed to Hirohito's watch as a disturbing sign of the post-war dominance of bourgeois American culture. Ultimately, the watch became part of Hirohito lore. His funeral in 1989 only reinforced that. The emperor asked to be buried with three prized possessions. One was a microscope he used for his marine biology studies. He was considered an expert in the field. Another was a list of Japan's greatest sumo wrestlers. Sumo was his favorite sport. And, of course, his Mickey watch. What are we to make of this? What explains an emperor's deep affection for an inexpensive souvenir of a trip to Disneyland? Was it a fascination with Mickey Mouse and the Disney legend? Was it a piece of Americana? Or of the prosperous Pax Americana that followed the nightmare of the war? Or was it something more personal, a made in the USA connection to the country that spared his life, chose not to try him as a war criminal, allowed him to stay on the chrysanthemum throne, and helped rebuild his country after conquering it? Was it stuff like that? Or was it the sheer fun of wearing and watching a funny watch, one that tells the time not only with two hands, but two arms, Mickey Mouse's arms? How nuts is that, right? You don't see that every day in the Imperial Palace, do you now? No, sir. Precisely what Hirohito loved about that watch, we'll never know. What we do know is how much he loved it, for whatever reasons. The funeral alone tells us that. And that, as all of you know, is the power of a watch. The amazing power to amuse, absorb, fascinate, even thrill, to not only do something, but to capture something, to mean something. For me, that's the lesson of the Hirohito story, and why I like it so much. Be it a Jorn, a Jaeger, a Bulova, or an Elgin Mickey, there's just something magical between a guy or a gal and a favorite watch. Thanks for tuning in and hanging in till the end. Talk to you later.
This week's episode was recorded at Hodinkee HQ in New York City and was produced and edited by Grayson Korhonen. Please remember to subscribe and rate the show. It really does make a difference for us. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.